From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. There's a new documentary out about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and the American soldier Bradley Manning. Manning is accused of leaking information to WikiLeaks. His trial begins on June 3rd. The film is called We Steal Secrets. It's by Alex Gibney. He made the Academy Award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side about the murder of a taxi driver at a U.S. air base in Afghanistan. On May 18th, I met Alex Gibney at an office in Ballard. He'd mentioned at a screening the previous evening of We Steal Secrets that before he started working on it, he saw WikiLeaks as a David and Goliath story. I asked him if he really went into it thinking it was Julian Assange versus Goliath.
Pretty much, honestly. I mean, he was such an intriguing and charismatic figure, Julian Assange. And the idea that he had the cojones to, sort of take this material and publish it and to put it out there and to really create this platform for a transnational publisher of secrets. It was tremendously impressive, I thought. And so, when I started the film, it was very much a kind of feeling of sign me up for the Julian Assange crusade. But along the way, things happen.
His premise is all these documents, all these information, all these facts are the truth. But as I was hearing him say that, I was wondering, does a big pile of facts always add up to the truth?
It doesn't. And that's something that people have to be very cautious of. And I think as we go forward, particularly if the Obama administration keeps cracking down on leaks and journalists, we have to wonder whether these electronic drop boxes, not only at WikiLeaks but at other places, will begin to get a bunch of disinformation as well as information. You have to be very careful about documents. Documents can be the truth, or they can be a partial truth, or sometimes they can be lies.
What do you think is the major accomplishment of having released the video and the documents from the Afghanistan war, the State Department documents? What was accomplished by all that?
It's like a grand moment that's akin to that moment in The Wizard of Oz when Toto pulls the curtain back and you see that the great and powerful Oz is in fact this old man operating some levers. You see the reality behind the illusion. And I think that's terribly important. And it was terribly important in this instance, even though I wouldn't recommend it going forward, that this much information was leaked, because we're at a moment in time where so much information by the U.S. government is being radically overclassified. And as a result, this moment in time was a kind of rough justice.
There was kind of a similar moment when Daniel Ellsberg gave the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times.
That's right.
Arguably, that turned the course of support against the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But as I sit back and look at the impact of the WikiLeaks leaks, I don't see that kind of impact. Do you?
No, but honestly, the problem that the WikiLeaks leaks face is that they're so broad. I mean, they encompass not just a war in Vietnam, but they encompass matters all over the world, whether they be in Yemen or Tunisia or North Korea or Mexico. The State Department cables in particular are just vast. So there's not that kind of focus. And I think, frankly, this country had a problem in the sense that we were in two wars. We were in Iraq. We were in Afghanistan. So I think it didn't have that kind of focused impact, in part because the leaks were so broad.
Let's talk about Julian Assange and the story. One of the things that you get to in this, and if you just joined us, I'm talking to Alex Gibney. We're talking about We Steal Secrets. It's his documentary about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. He is facing charges in Sweden filed by two women. They say he had unprotected sex with them. In one case, they say he ripped a condom. And you got to interview one of the women who filed these charges against Assange. She's in disguise. What did you learn from digging into this part of the story?
Well, first, a couple of bits of backpedaling. No charges have been filed, and these women didn't file charges. What happened was these women went to Julian or went to a guy named Donald Bostrom, who was one of Julian's hosts in Sweden, and wanted Julian to take an HIV test because he had had unprotected sex with both of them. Julian refused. over the course of a number of days, they finally persuaded him to do it. By then, it was too late. The clinic had closed. They were so frustrated, they went to the police to see if the police would force Julian to take an HIV test. Once they began to give testimony to the police, it was at that point that the police and the Swedish prosecutor decided to pursue these allegations to see if there was a crime here. And that's where we sit now.
No charges have been filed. They're still investigating whether a crime has taken place.
Well, this is where it gets a little tricky in the Swedish justice system. Julian will say no charges have been filed. He's technically correct. Frankly, though, the investigation has moved past that point. The Swedish prosecutor would say that if they could get Julian to Sweden and could arrest him there, they most likely would charge him. But in Swedish law, you can't charge somebody until they've been arrested. That has to be in Sweden. So as long as Julian stays out of Sweden, he will never be charged. That's why his claims that there are no charges are a little bit disingenuous.
Well, one of the most interesting things this woman says is, we approached him afterwards and we said, just get an HIV test. We just want to know whether there's some problem with a possible sexually transmitted disease. We're not interested in taking it any further. And according to this woman, Assange just refused.
That is absolutely correct. On such things, the course of history falls. I mean, all he had to do was be a little bit less arrogant and say, okay, look, these women are upset. I'll go take an HIV test. And none of this would have happened.
Whether there are charges, whether he's ever prosecuted of something, that appears to be the thread that came undone that really has led to the downfall. There were other factors, but that seemed to be a deciding factor.
I guess so. I mean, when you say downfall, I mean, it's led to him seeking asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. I think my concern and the reason this story figures so prominently in the film, and we should say that it's not all about this, it's just a portion. But the reason I think this is important is that WikiLeaks is a kind of beacon for truth-telling. And yet I think what Julian did with this Swedish episode was to create a kind of irresponsible lie around this whole Swedish episode that focused his supporters on supporting him because it seemed like there was some kind of put-up job, a grand conspiracy, to produce these phony allegations or to extradite him to the United States. I looked into this very carefully, and so far as I'm concerned, so far as I've been able to determine, none of that is true. So that's the important part here, is that at the heart of the WikiLeaks story, a truth-telling organization is a lie, and if that's a downfall, then yes.
Well, the U.S. government and others who were just outraged at the release of these documents from mm-hmm. the State Department and elsewhere also were extremely effective. Because we have to recall that they were not just put out by WikiLeaks, they were also published in The Guardian, they were published in The New York Times, and yet the government counterattack, as you point out in the film, very effectively sidestepped those journalistic organizations and went right at WikiLeaks and Assange.
That's right. And that's, I think, the lesson to be learned here for episodes like this going forward. I mean, the papers, the newspapers, were offering Assange a certain kind of political immunity, so long as they were together. And it was the breaking apart of that momentary alliance between Julian, the transparency radical, and these mainstream news organizations that allowed the U.S. government to pounce and to separate Assange from that alliance. I think also Julian deserves some of the blame there, too, because he wasn't in a position to really be listening very carefully. He was reckless about how he was publishing the documents. He hadn't given any real thought to how they should be redacted so that you could protect sources in the field in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Several people talked to him as being a rock star when he came out with these revelations. We can recall he was followed everywhere. He was considered a superstar, a hero to many, and still is a hero to many. However, when you sat down, when you tried to get an interview with him to talk to him, some very interesting things followed from that. What happened?
Well, sometimes when you approach a rock star is surrounded by lawyers and agents and road managers, and it's very hard to get to the rock star. That was certainly the case with Julian Assange. I met him. The first time I met him at the Frontline Club in London, I liked him. You know, he had a kind of self-deprecating wit. He was clearly very smart. I went to his 40th birthday party. One of my executive producers had actually contributed to his bail. And he agreed at one time to do an interview, then rescinded that agreement. It became a very contentious issue. And over time, it seemed that he wanted to do the interview only if he could utterly control it. In other words, if I would agree to be part of his message. He wasn't very interested, or he wasn't interested at all, in simply telling a story that would be integrated into the story that I was telling. And he was offended to some extent when I told him early on that I was going to do this story whether he participated or not. And so things ultimately broke down. He asked for money. I wouldn't give him money.
$1 million?
Well, he said he didn't ask for $1 million. It was cagier than that. He said, perhaps you could give me money and the market rate for an interview with me is $1 million. I had to wonder what market that was. You know, the Guangzhou Growth Fund? I didn't know. Since he had been interviewed by just about everybody on the planet, in fact, I joked with him that maybe I was the only person in the world who hadn't interviewed him. Then when that broke down, I told him I didn't pay for interviews. He said, well, how about you go and get me intel on all the other interview subjects and report back to me with what those people are saying, and then perhaps I'll agree to an interview. So he was asking me, this guy, this transparency radical, was asking me to spy on these other people for his benefit.
Alex Gibney is my guest, and we're talking about his new documentary. It's called We Steal Secrets. You might be familiar with his work, Client 9, about Elliot Spitzer, or Magic Trip about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. The new film really brings us up to date on what's gone on in the last couple of years with this case of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and the very complicated story behind it, and also kind of what's gone on since then. And one of the saddest parts of it is you interview many of his colleagues and we see their pride in what they had accomplished with WikiLeaks sour, and their attitude toward Assange really sour towards the end, to the degree that at one point, I believe some of them say they were asked to sign confidentiality agreements.
Non-disclosure agreements, for which the penalty was something over $12 million. It was farcical that a transparency organization could be demanding these kind of documents that really are the kind of things that keep whistleblowers quiet. But I think it should be said that while a number of people who came across WikiLeaks and either worked with WikiLeaks or inside WikiLeaks or was part of a group that was admiring of WikiLeaks, I think they retained their admiration for the initial goal of the organization and for much of what it did. So that needs to be recognized. Just because people may have fallen out with what WikiLeaks became, what WikiLeaks represented at its very best is something that I think everybody is still very much in support of, those people who were part of the WikiLeaks group.
And you talk a lot about, of course, the fate of Bradley Manning, who I understand is going to be on trial on June 4th, that's coming up. He's the low-level Army official who turned a lot of these documents over and later was betrayed by a close friend. And I got to say, that's an extremely poignant part of the film. You chose to tell his story basically by putting his text messages up, and we see the view of a very troubled young man, a very confused young man, just trying in some way to react to this horrible material he's reading, and it's a very touching part of the movie.
Yeah, Bradley Manning comes out as kind of the poignant hero of this story. He was troubled, and he was going through a personal crisis. He wanted to make a difference in his own life, possibly even to change his sex. And at the same time, he was going through a kind of political consciousness raising. He saw materials in these documents that deeply upset him, and he felt that somehow this information should be known. The thing that's important about Bradley's personal life is that he was also a very vulnerable and needy guy who reached out to somebody after he had leaked this material to WikiLeaks because he needed somebody to talk to. That's the interesting thing about the relationship between a source and a journalist or a source and a publisher. Sometimes there's a kind of personal relationship there that's very, very, very important on an ongoing basis. And if you don't have somebody to talk to, you reach out to somebody else. In this case, he reached out to the person who turned him in.
And there's that strain of criticism of the journalist that he or she will always betray the source in some way. And you must feel that responsibility when you're talking to sources.
Sure. And it is a matter of trust. And I think it was WikiLeaks' contention that all of that could be eliminated with this electronic Dropbox. It could now be a kind of mechanical exchange or an electronic exchange, something that no longer needed human beings to interpose themselves. But I think that turned out to be not necessarily so. The fact is that despite all those protections, those technical protections, Bradley Manning was outed, in part because he had emotional needs that weren't being met.
There's also the impact of releasing all this government information and the culture of everything being revealed that Julian Assange espoused kind of runs into what journalists do, which is be somewhat more judicious or afraid, I suppose, if you were a critique of it. And these kind of two attitudes clash when it comes to what to put out and what the impact of it might be. And you reveal that in the film, too.
Yeah, look, I think Julian is much more radical in terms of what he would consider should be released. There's very little, I think, that he thinks shouldn't be released. I think he may have gotten something of an education about that over time, but he was never, ever willing to recognize that he ever had any blind spot. That was, I think, Julian's fatal flaw, is that he would never admit to a mistake. He would never, and if you can't admit to mistakes, you can't get better. So that was a problem. But this whole issue of that balance between what to release and what not to release is a terribly important one, which is at the heart of this film.
And it gets to the point where one of the people who worked with him quoted him as saying, and I'll get this not exactly right, something to the effect of if some of these Afghani civilians who cooperated with the authorities happen to get killed because their names come out in these documents, well, they deserve it.
They deserve to die because they're collaborators, in effect. That was something that Nick Davis, who was was the Guardian reporter who brought Julian into the Guardian, said. And it was a conversation just between the two of them. And I think it was probably, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. I asked Nick Davis again, are you sure he said that? He said, absolutely. Julian has denied this. But I think that was probably something that Julian said in an arch, high-handed, and dismissive way that sort of represented his larger view. I think he came to change his mind, but he was unwilling to say to anybody, oh, we've got a problem here. And instead, things rolled forward so that when the release happened, there were a lot of names that were unredacted in what WikiLeaks published, and that caused the problem in a way that caused the vulnerability that allowed the U.S. government to marginalize Assange relative to the New York Times and the Guardian.
At the end of the day, has Julian Assange and WikiLeaks moved forward the idea that we get more openness from our government, moved it backward? Is it the same way it was before?
No, I think they've moved it forward. It's sort of two steps forward and one step back. I think because of the recklessness of what WikiLeaks did at times during this process, there is, I think, a distrust of the process. Yet at the same time, we have to acknowledge that nobody got killed as a result of these leaks. You know, the U.S. officials kept saying WikiLeaks or Assange has blood on his hands, but he didn't. And the blood was really the massive amount of blood that was being spilled in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that overall, when we look back at this moment in history, we'll say that this WikiLeaks episode helped to advance the cause of transparency, but there were problems that rose up as a result of this that caused problems as well.
Filmmaker Alex Gibney, his film about WikiLeaks is called We Steal Secrets. The title comes not from Julian Assange, but from former CIA director Michael Hayden. In true WikiLeaks style, they have published the transcript of the entire film along with an annotated commentary on their thoughts on what was said in it.